Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ sanghaṃ namassāmi. So today's sutta is the Ganaka Moggallana Sutta. And the reason I chose this one is it does fit in with the talk I gave on Friday night about the authority in the Sangha and who will lead the Sangha after the Buddha passed away. But also it has one of the favorite quotes about meditation and what meditation the Buddha praised, what the Buddha didn't praise. It's set in a historical context, and this is one of those suttas whose context makes it very clear that this is just after the passing away of the Buddha. So it's interesting, for those of you who read these suttas carefully, you'll always see the beginning goes, thus I have heard on one occasion, and they usually say on one occasion the Buddha was staying somewhere, even though it may be concerning an event which happened in a place where the Buddha wasn't living. They'd always say at the beginning of a sutta, on this occasion the Buddha was staying at so and such a place. But here we don't see that. Instead we have, thus I have heard on one occasion Venerable Ananda was living at Rajagaha. And it also says afterwards, not long after the Blessed One had attained to final Nibbana. So teaching which happened after the time of the Buddha, but obviously not that long after. And we know this historically, that King Ajatasattu, who had his capital at Rajagaha, and those of you who've been on pilgrimage would have seen that area bounded by mountains, and one of the places you will go on that pilgrimage is the Vulture's Peak, and there you see this empty plain, because history said that after Ajatasattu was building up the city of Rajagaha, the air was not very good there. They actually moved the city outside of the mountains, and then eventually changed the capital over to what's now Patna. And one can see some of the only very few ruins within that area. But what was always very impressive to me is actually on Vulture's Peak, you look down on that area, and that was one of the biggest cities in the time of the Buddha, Rajagaha, where this actually took place. And now there is just scrub and empty land. And there's hardly any remnants of what was once a great city. Shortly after the passing away of the Buddha, they put the Rajagaha outside, this mountain-ringed little plain, and eventually they changed the capital to Patna. So it's one way we can actually tell the historical validity of this episode. So thus have I heard, on one occasion the Venerable Ananda was living at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove in the squirrel sanctuary, not long after the Blessed One had attained to final Nibbana. And the bamboo grove is very easy to find out where that is. It's not because there's lots of bamboo there. I think the bamboo you see there these days has been planted quite recently. But it's just next to these hot springs, and the hot springs of Rajagaha are now used by the Jains, and they, even today, many, many people bathe in those hot springs. And if you go on pilgrimage there, you're also invited to bathe in there, but you'd have to take a very long shower after bathing there to get clean again. It's very dirty. Now, on that occasion, a King Ajatasattu Vaidahiputta of Magadha, so Magadha was the kingdom centered around Rajagaha, which eventually grew to take over most of India. He became suspicious of King Prajota, who was a king who lived far to the west, and so he was having Rajagaha fortified. Then when it was morning, the Venerable Ananda, dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Rajagaha for alms, went on alms round. But the Venerable Ananda thought, it is still too early to wander for alms in Rajagaha. Suppose I went to the Brahmin Gopika Moggallana at his workplace. And Gopika literally means like a cowherd. So the Venerable Ananda went to the Brahmin Gopika Moggallana at his workplace. And the Brahmin Gopika Moggallana saw the Venerable Ananda coming in the distance and said to him, "Let Master Ananda come. Welcome to Master Ananda. It is long since Master Ananda found an opportunity to come here. Let Master Ananda be seated. The seat is ready." Which is a standard description in the time of the Buddha of welcoming someone. So the next week, when Sister Ajahn Wayama comes here to give the Friday night talk, you could welcome her in the traditional Buddhist way. Let Sister Ajahn Wayama come. Welcome to Sister Ajahn Wayama. It is a long time since Sister Ajahn Wayama found an opportunity to come here. Let Sister Ajahn Wayama be seated. The seat is ready. And you will impress her. The Venerable Ananda sat down on the seat made ready, and the Brahmin Gopika Moggallana took a low seat and sat down at one side and asked the Venerable Ananda the following. It was always the case, even in these days in Thailand, or maybe in Sri Lanka, you never actually sit right in front of a teacher. You always sit little side, never right in front. Because if you sit right in front, it's almost say, "Look at me," and don't look at anybody else. And sometimes, you know, even that's happened when I've been teaching sometimes. Sometimes plonks themselves right in front. And it's obvious they want attention. So always take a seat slightly to the side. It's a very subtle but very beautiful gesture. So the Brahmin Gopika Moggallana took a low seat, sat down at one side and asked the Venerable Ananda, "Master Ananda, is there any single bhikkhu, that means monk, who possesses in each and every way all those qualities that were possessed by Master Gotama, accomplished and fully enlightened?" In other words, has the Buddha got an equal there? Now, it's very interesting what Ananda answers here. He says, "There is no single monk, Brahmin, who possesses in each and every way all those qualities that were possessed by the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened. For the Blessed One, the Buddha, was the arouser of the unarisen path, the producer of the unproduced path, the declarer of the undeclared path. He was a knower of the path, the finder of the path, the one skilled in the path. But his disciples now abide following that path and become possessed of it afterwards." So if you look at that phrase in greater detail, you see there that Ananda is not saying there were monks or nuns who were deeper meditators, who were wiser, or who had more psychic powers. He makes a differentiation between the Buddha and the other great enlightened monks and nuns of that time, only to the fact that the Buddha was number one in finding the path, in discovering the path. And that was the only difference which Ananda was emphasizing here. So the actual attainments and the qualities of wisdom, insight, whatever, were not singled out by Ananda. The only thing which he said made a difference was the Buddha was a discoverer of that path, and everyone else is possessed of it. So sometimes that when we ask what's the difference between a Buddha and an enlightened person, it's only a chronological difference. The Buddha was the first in line. Other people came afterwards. And there's not that much difference otherwise. Any comments about that? Yes. Yes, sir, Bongri? Yes, no, it's the attainment of enlightenment will be the same for every person. The point is that the Buddha was the first there. And obviously we have different characters of being able to give Dhamma talks or psychic powers or other such things. But he was almost saying here, at least Ananda was pointing out, this was the only major difference. There were other monks who had as much wisdom, as good meditation, and as great compassion, as great asceticism, whatever qualities you want to point out. But the only main difference Ananda is pointing out here, it's nothing to do with that. It was only to do with the Buddha was first and the other one was afterwards. And this is a common theme which you see going through Buddhism, which is like an anti-elitism. So we don't want to have like grades of enlightenment. And it's not like the army where you become sort of a captain and then a major and then a sort of a colonel, a general, a lieutenant general, a major general or a field marshal. So that once you're enlightened, you're just enlightened, that's all. And not sort of, I'm super enlightened, I'm more enlightened than you are. That sort of elitism was very clearly absent in the early Buddhism. And that's also a reason. I've mentioned this, I think, in a few talks, but seeing as you asked a question or that comes on from your question, that monks, nuns were not allowed, permitted, to actually let on any of their attainments, how enlightened they were. And a monk in Thailand once wrote a very perceptive article, and the reason why was if there was monks and nuns would say about their enlightenment, then we would have like almost like a class system in the monastic orders. You'd have the elite, which were the enlightened ones, and then you'd have what, for want of a better word, is the riffraff monks who hadn't got enlightened yet. And that sort of caste system, the Buddha, having seen how that caste system created so much trouble amongst the ordinary people of India, he didn't want to have such a caste system, such elitism in his monastic order. So seeing that if all the monks had to say exactly what they were doing and how attained they were or how non-attained they were, there would be an automatic sort of class system within the monastic order. And because of that, they would create all sorts of trouble and problems. So the Buddha actually tried to keep that away straight away by not allowing people to actually to say that. So as you know now that you haven't got a clue, it's sort of in, say, even in Bodhinyana Monastery or in Dharmasara, exactly where the monks and nuns are at. You may have some conjectures, but you don't really know. And that way that we're all treated equally. Make any sense? Any comments or questions on that? Okay. But this discussion between the Venerable Ananda and the Brahmin Gopika Moggallana was interrupted, for then the Brahmin Vasakara, the minister of Magadha, while supervising the work at Rajagaha, went to the Venerable Ananda at the workplace of the Brahmin Gopika Moggallana. So Vasakara, he was one of the ministers, what you'd call these days a minister of works. And even these days, because of this fellow Vasakara, the name, in the Thai language anyway, for a builder, or especially an architect, is Vasagorn, which actually comes from Vasakara, someone who does the building works. So they've actually taken a name here and used that as their name for an architect or a builder. Maybe Wimal. What's the Sinhala name for an architect or a builder? Anything different? Vasakara or Vasakram? Krom or something? You don't remember? Vasya. Oh, yeah, Vasya. Okay, probably the Vasa is coming from probably from this word as well. Anyway, I just like some of these connections between these old names and some of the words we have these days. So he was the minister in charge of works, and because they were reinforcing the town fortifications, because they were expecting an attack from another king, it never happened as it was, therefore he was wandering around and he saw Ananda at Gopika Moggallana's place. So he exchanged greetings with the Venerable Ananda, and when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and asked the Venerable Ananda, "For what discussion are you sitting together here now, Master Ananda, and what was your discussion that was interrupted?" "Brahmin, The Brahmin Gopika Moggallana asked me, Master Ananda, is there any single bhikkhu who possesses in each and every way all those qualities that were possessed by Master Gotama, accomplished and fully enlightened? And I replied to the Brahmin Gopika Moggallana, there is no single monk, Brahmin, who possesses in each and every way all those qualities that were possessed by the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened. For the Blessed One was the arouser of the unarisen path, as said before. But his disciples now abide following that path, and become possessed of it afterwards. This was our discussion that was interrupted when you arrived. So the Minister of Works carried on. Is there, Master Ananda, any single monk who was appointed by Master Gotama thus? He will be your refuge when I am gone, and whom you now have recourse to. And it was this question here which made me choose this sutta today, because those of you who are here on a Friday night heard me say that the Buddha made it very clear, even before he passed away, that there'll be no leader of Buddhism after he passed away. There's no person he was going to appoint under which all the Buddhas would take refuge and have recourse to. And this is reinforced here by Ananda's answer. There is no single monk, Brahmin, who has been chosen by the Sangha and appointed by a number of elder bhikkhus. There is no single bhikkhu Brahmin who was appointed by the Buddha, the Blessed One, who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened thus. He will be your refuge when I am gone, and whom we now have recourse to. The Buddha never appointed anybody. So the next question, well, if the Buddha never appointed anyone, you know, the Sangha, the group, have you appointed someone? But is there, Master Ananda, any single monk who has been chosen by the Sangha and appointed by a number of elder monks? Thus, he will be our refuge after the Blessed One has gone, and whom you now have recourse to. There is no single monk, Brahmin, who has been chosen by the Sangha, and appointed by a number of elder monks. Thus, he will be our refuge after the Blessed One has gone, and whom we now have recourse to. So neither the Buddha nor the organization had appointed anybody. And now, sort of, because, remember, this was a kingdom, and the minister was used to hierarchies, he asked the obvious question now, but if you have no refuge, Master Ananda, what is the cause for your concord? How can you keep harmonious when you have no figurehead? We are not without a refuge, Brahmin. We have a refuge. We have the Dhamma, the truth, as our refuge. And of course, this is one of those very powerful statements which the Buddha made. And obviously, all the monks heard this, understood this, and Ananda, one of his closest disciples, is now repeating it. The Dhamma is our refuge now that the Buddha has passed away. And you can see here what the refuge means. It is like your leader, your boss, where you take recourse to rather than any person. And it's sometimes that it's underestimated the power of that strategy which the Buddha initiated. If he had elected a leader, then in the rest of history, they'd be continuing to elect leaders. And we'd always have a boss of Buddhism, no matter what, I don't know what you would call it. And as we all know what happens in history, whenever you have such a powerful leader, there's always some corruption happens. And the sort of people who shouldn't become leaders, they're the ones who usually do become leaders. And anyone who's got any sense would try and avoid being a leader at all costs, which means that usually the leadership attracts those least people who are competent. But to avoid that, the Buddha said, no, you don't need a leader. Let the Dhamma be your leader. And the same way there that Ananda is answering, that is the reason why we have concord and harmony. And again, that's a very profound statement, because when you do have a person who's your leader, some people like them, some people don't, and there's never any harmony. Just reading the paper this morning, last week's re-election of the leader of the Labour Party just shows that. You know, there's always going to be some jockeying for power, and that would even happen in the Sangha. But when here the Buddha says, the Sangha says, no, let the Dhamma be your leader. Then he said, that's the reason for our concord. But this was not understood by the minister, Wasukara, because he continued by saying, "But when you are asked, is there Master Ananda, any single monk who was appointed by Master Gotama thus, he will be your refuge when I am gone, and whom you now have recourse to?" You answer, "There is no such single monk whom we now have recourse to." When you ask, "Is there Master Ananda, any single monk who has been chosen by the Sangha and appointed by a number of elder monks thus, he will be our refuge after the Blessed One has gone, and whom you now have recourse to?" You answer, "There is no such single monk whom you now have recourse to." And now when you were asked, "But you, if you have no refuge, Master Ananda, what is the cause for your harmony?" You answered, "We are not without a refuge, Brahmin. We have a refuge. We have the Dhamma as our refuge." Now, how should the meaning of these statements be regarded, Master Ananda? How can this work? You can have just a principle as a leader rather than a person. And Ananda replies, "Brahmin, the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened, that's the Buddha, has prescribed a course of training for monks, and he has laid down the Patimokkha. These are the rules of discipline which we chant every fortnight, which are the basic rules which a monk lives by. You know, has such rules as celibacy, and also such rules as not killing living beings, such rules as not having any money. On the Uposatha day, which is every fortnight following the full moon or the new moon, on the Uposatha day, as many of us as live in dependence upon a single village district meet together in unison. And when we meet, we ask one who knows the Patimokkha rules to recite it. If a monk remembers an offence or transgression while the Patimokkha is being recited, we'll deal with him according to the Dhamma in the way that we have been instructed. It is not the worthy ones who deal with us, it is the Dhamma which deals with us." And I don't know, some of you may have stayed at the monastery in Serpentine and seen every fortnight all the Sangha meet together. And one of us, in turn, chants these 227 rules. It takes between about 45 minutes and 50 minutes, and many of us have learnt that by heart. And the point is here, that's a way of reminding us what the rules are. And if any monk has broken any of those rules, the way it's dealt with is nearly in all cases, we just confess our mistakes to one of the other monks, acknowledge our mistake, and then afterwards that the monk just says, "I'll try and be more restrained in the future." Yes, and that's it. So acknowledgement is all we need. There is no penances, usually, for breaking an offence. The sort of examples of that is, you know, like sometimes we're not allowed to receive money, but every now and again, like just a few days ago, somebody sent me a letter, a disciple in Sydney. It was like a Christmas greeting, and inside the letter was $20. And of course, there was no way of me knowing there was any money inside the letter. So of course, as soon as I opened it, I asked one of the laymen staying in the monastery, "Please take the $20 and whatever you want to do with it, in the donation box or whatever." And then, even though there was no intention there, it's still an offence. So I just have to go and tell that to another monk. I just received $20. And, you know, being more restrained in the future, yes, and that's it, finished. So you see, it's a principle we're dealing with this. You don't have to go to sort of some judge and the judge decides what penalty you have to do. It's all been settled by the Buddha. And that means that it's a code which creates harmony in the sense you don't have to argue with anybody about what to do. And the whole rules of discipline called the Patimokkha. You can see, having lived by those rules for over 32 years now, you can understand that one of the major goals which it achieves quite admirably is to create harmony and peace. Yes? Yeah, they're part of the Dhamma, yes. They're encompassed by it. But they also express it as well. Because one of the, having again lived by it and studied it and got a good understanding of it, it is, harmony is the most important thing in those rules. Even to the point that if I see any monk who's making a mistake, even before that I can admonish him and tell him off, because I'm supposed to be the abbot, I have got many reflections in myself, first of all, such as, am I doing something just as bad as they are doing? And is it the right time and place? Am I speaking with kindness, or am I just trying to pick fault in that guy? And even if all of those questions are answered, before I admonish him, I have to say, may I have permission to admonish you first of all? And it's a very, very refined way of teaching and reminding each other. And if there's any reason I think that, you know, he may have just done a small offense, and if it's going to create more upset and disharmony in the community, I'm obliged just to leave it alone and cover it up with grass. Because the harmony is one of the most important parts of the rules here, to preserve that harmony. So the harmony is such a huge thing when you look at the rules for monks, that you cannot use those rules to create disharmony. Yes. Supreme Patriarch in Thailand. There is what's called a Sangha Raja, which is sometimes called Supreme Patriarch. But the point is, they don't have power. The only power they have is what the King of Thailand, or rather the government of Thailand, confers on them. And it's a secular power, not an ecclesiastical power. And every now and again, that is made quite clear whenever there's any group in, say, Thailand, or a monk in Thailand, who they think is misbehaving. It's very often the monk would actually say, no, the Dhamma is the only thing which can discipline me. And all the monks know that he has a point there. So if you actually look at the supreme patriarchs, or even like the Mahanayakas, which is literally the great leaders in Sri Lanka, most of their role is actually ceremonial. They are more like the heads of state rather than actually presidents or prime ministers. They usually officiate at ceremonies to represent the Sangha, but they don't really have much formal power. And when you go to actually the rules and the essence of Buddhism, they have zero power. All the power will lie amongst the individual group of monks. Yes? Indeed, even the Dalai Lama, the only authority he has is what their group confers on him. But as far as the original teachings, Buddhism is concerned, he has not as much power as Venerable Sona, no more, no less. Which is, sometimes people find that quite strange, that whenever we have anything to discuss in our monastery, we take a vote on it. And, you know, even though I've been there for so long, you know, I have the same vote as, say, Venerable Sona. And, you know, you've only been ordained how long? No. A year, yeah. And I've been 32 years. But we just have the same vote. Sometimes I thought, well, you know, to get my own way, I should have 32 votes. He only has one vote. But that's only a joke. I haven't been able to get away with that one yet. And that's the way it's always been. So it is the community has the power. So even if the Sangha Raja was visiting our monastery, or Mahanayaka, and we had a discussion about, you know, whether we should give a talk tonight, or whether we should have this book in the library or not in the library, he would just have the same vote as anybody else. Yeah? Yes? Well, this is the misinformation to the Western media, because I think in the West, so every other religion has its head, has its leader. You have archbishops, you have popes, you have ayatollahs, and Buddhism is different religion. You don't have those things, but nevertheless, that in his sect, he has given accorded status. He was a leader of a country, he was a civil leader, and that has been sometimes confused with his monk status. If you ask him, very often he says, I'm just a simple monk. And you know, what he means there is very, very true. In, as far as monkness is concerned, he's no different in his authority than anybody else. But in practical terms, obviously he does have authority. In the same way that, you know, I'm the spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of WA and the abbot of the monastery, so I do have some authority there. I do have more authority, obviously, than Venerable Sona. But when push comes to shove, when we actually get right back to the basics, then I have no authority at all. No more than any other monk. The Dhamma is the authority. That's right, more headaches, yeah. More lines on the face. Yeah. More access to the Panadol. You had a question? Yeah. It's sometimes it's very difficult. Sometimes people say, oh, I wish there was a leader who could sort this out. But usually it sorts itself out naturally. A good example of that, there was a group in Malaysia, and they're still contacting me. There was some problem in their monastery. And I was there recently. I'm going back there again next week, and they've already sent me a heap of paper about what this monk has done and what this monk hasn't done or whatever. But in the end, that it's up to them to sort it out themselves. And usually what happens, if there is any monastery which is misbehaving and acting not in accordance with, you know, what really is Buddhism, it soon becomes quite evident, you know, that things go wrong and it doesn't feel good, and sometimes people get exploited. You get shouted at, or, you know, money disappears or whatever, and you see the monks going around with gold rich watches or something. And in the end, what actually happens is the corruption gets so obvious that people just leave them alone. They don't give them any respect. And so the whole thing falls apart. There is a natural safeguard. It's the same as you see here. The only reason why our monasteries here are prospered is because, you know, you have some respect for what we do. You come and have a look to see how we behave. And if it really is according to Dhamma, and then there will be some growth, and, you know, people will be inspired. But if it's, you know, against the Dhamma and it's exploiting, like some cult asking you for all your money and exploiting people, then actually you'll see this doesn't feel right and people won't support it anymore. And that way it dies. In the same way that a tree in a forest, if it's a good tree and not diseased, it will flourish. If it's a bad tree and it's got diseases, it dies. So monasteries, communities do die, you know, if they're not following Dhamma. It's a much slower process than if there was someone to intervene, but it so saves the problem of intervention where there's, you know, other issues at stake, you know, power trips, you know, like the inquisitions of Christianity or the fatwas of entrenched groups in Islam. And here there's much more freedom. Its downside is that you can have a corrupt group and it lasts much longer. But the good part of that is that there's no power trips and there's no none of the bad results of hierarchies and powers. Indeed, you don't have the elite in-group, and the power does corrupt. It's quite clear. And, you know, if I had such great power, then people would try and be influencing me to get what they want. And, you know, have an extra couple of tea bags, Ajahn Brahm, or whatever it is. There's so many ways that people try and ingratiate themselves with people who have power. And the people, unless they are very, very strong, they will get sucked in or affected, you know, by people who lobby, you know, the Mr. Burks of this world. But we don't have that in Buddhism, which is great. It does, and also not just their integrity, but also their knowledge of what Buddhism really is. And that's why we read out these suttas, and where we emphasize these points. So here you see this is not just coming from Ajahn Brahm, you've read it for yourself and see it. That we have Dhamma as our refuge. Now, the Buddha never elected a successor, neither did the Sangha say, on this monk you should have refuge in. So you can see here that, you know, a Mahanayaka or a Sangharaja or a Supreme Patriarch goes against the spirit which you read here. But then how can we have concord? How can there be a harmony? How can we move forward? You see here that he gives the example of like the rules, and the rules are there, and they deal with the problem. And the Dhamma, the truth, is something you can always appeal to. Yes. If they say there's like a fanatical Buddhist group goes and moves into the area, and they say that, like the guru tradition. You know, there's one person saying, no, our guru is fully enlightened, he's got magical powers, he's the real Buddha of our age, you know, follow him. In the end, it's the Dhamma will be the protector here, because when the Dhamma is taught, you can read it for yourself, you understand it for yourself. Then you go to that teacher and say, I'm sorry, sir, you're wrong. It doesn't make sense. And it's not, you know, one monk arguing against another monk. You can see it in the books here. And you say, well, this is not what the Buddha said. You can be intimidated, but in the end, what actually happens is that the best way to overcome the false teachings or wrong ideas is never to attack the false teachings or to put down the wrong ideas. The best way to overcome misunderstandings or wrong ideas is to present clearly good teachings. And that was a saying of a philosopher a long time ago. He said, don't argue against other teachings, just present better ones and let people understand. And so that we never actually, you've probably heard here, we never go around putting down this group or that group. Even though you can get a lot of people excited if you use ways of negativity. Down with the Muslims, down with the Christians, down with these people, down with those people. People love that sort of stuff. It gets you excited and say, yeah, yeah, yeah. But that's not the Dhamma. The Dhamma just doesn't criticize others. It just praises what is good and lets people make their own choice. So if there was a bad teacher, we wouldn't really go to town on them, putting them down. We'd just create better teachings, and so they would have no support. Okay, let's go carry on here. Paragraph 11. Is there, Master Ananda, any single monk whom you now honour, respect, revere and venerate, and on whom you live in dependence, honouring and respecting him? It's a different question here. This is like respect and honour, rather than take him as your refuge, as your leader. So we still have that, obviously. There's people we really respect. And there is a single monk, Brahmin, whom we now honour, respect, revere and venerate, and on whom we live in dependence, honouring and respecting him. It looks like that actually there is a leader now. And so Wasakara, Minister of Works, picks this point up. But when you are asked, is there, Master Ananda, any single monk who was appointed by Master Gotama? You said there is no such monk. When you are asked, is there any single monk who has been chosen by the Sangha? You answered, there is no such monk. When you ask, is there, Master, any single monk whom you honour, respect, revere and venerate, on whom you live in dependence, honouring and respecting him, you answered, there is such a single monk whom we now honour and on whom we live in dependence, honouring and respecting him. Now, how should the meaning of these statements be regarded, Master Ananda? Have you contradicted yourself? First you said there's no leader, now there is. And it's a different idea of what a leader is here. This is not the person who told you what to do. This is like the example who you honour and revere, you respect. But you find out now this isn't a monk by this and that name, it's a type of monk or nun. There are, Brahmin, 10 qualities inspiring confidence that have been declared by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened, that's the Buddha. When these qualities are found in anyone among us, we honour, respect, revere and venerate him, and live in dependence on him, honouring and respecting him. What are the 10? So this is the 10 qualities. You know, either one of which or many of which make a person a good example for other monks to follow. Here, Brahmin, a monk is virtuous. He dwells restrained with the restraint of the Patimokkha, the monastic rules. He is perfect in conduct and resort. His actually physical conduct and his resort is actually where you go to. In other words, you don't go to pubs. You don't go to the Wacker to see the test match. You don't go into the movie theatres. In other words, you see the monk, they're going to the places where monks belong. And you see fear. Or actually, not fear is the wrong word there. Should be see a danger in the slightest faults. And he trains himself by undertaking the training precepts. And I always mention this to the monks in my monastery. It's not fear, that's the wrong word, a bad translation. You see danger in the slightest faults, and even a small fault. You know, you don't go and get terrified and paranoid about making mistakes, but you see the danger in them. You know, that if, for example, I talk to a lady alone, you know, there is a danger there. So you see that, you know, people will see me, I'm talking to them for too long. Think, oh, what's Ajahn Brahm up to? Is she his mistress? Is something going on there? And people actually do think that way after a while. So you see the danger in those thoughts. So that's number one. So in other words, you've got good conduct. You're virtuous and you're seen to be virtuous. Number two, they have learned much and remember what they have learned and consolidated what they have learned. Such teachings, and it's usual way of describing good teachings, as are good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing, which can affirm a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. Such teachings as these he has learned much of, remembered, mastered verbally, investigated with the mind, and penetrating well by view. In other words, someone who knows what they're talking about, who's learned a lot. Number three, someone who is content with their robes, arms, food, resting place, and medicinal requisite. In other words, someone who doesn't have many, many things. So it's very clear from the monastic rules, or the ideal of a monk, a person who you revere, is not the person who has, you know, the huge mansion for their hut, not the one who goes around in Rolls Royces, who has the most expensive of belongings, but someone who is content with little. Number four, someone who obtains at will without trouble or difficulty the four jhanas that constitute the higher mind and provide a pleasant abiding here and now. So someone who knows how to meditate deeply. Number five, someone who wields various kinds of supernormal power. Having been one, they become many. Having been many, they become one. And apparently it was from this that I've never seen that movie, but apparently in The Matrix, some of the younger monks have seen that. There's one character there who actually does that. They're one and they become many, or they're many and they become one. And I think that idea actually came from Buddhism. So Buddhism actually influenced modern culture in The Matrix movie, apparently. And he appears and vanishes. He goes unhindered through a wall, through an enclosure, through a mountain, as though through space. He can dive in and out of the earth as though it were water. They walk on water without sinking as though it were earth. And seated cross-legged, they travel in space like a bird. So, I remember when I used to see Superman on the TV when I was a kid. They say, is it a bird plane? Is it a bird? No, it's a monk, not Superman. Sorry? No, it's true. No, this was all these tales about monks who've been seen meditating and flying through the air. Oh, yeah. The famous monk in Thailand, he was actually seen by a jet pilot sitting on a cloud, I don't know how many, 10,000 feet. And this jet pilot saw him very clearly and was obviously he didn't actually see his features and face that clearly. Because going fast, obviously, but saw this monk sitting on a cloud. He was just so shocked by it that he noted the area on his map where it was. And when he had some time off, he went to that area and just asked, are there any meditation monks in this area? And when they sort of showed him a few of the meditation monks, he went to one and said, oh, that's the guy. And he actually found him. And of course, from that time on, he became very famous. And there's a monk in Burma that, if you want to get this story, get it from Wayne Finn, and became very famous because there wasn't a jet fighter, but there was a guy driving his train along the tracks. And then there was a monk came out of the jungle and actually just flew in front of the train. And if I remember the story correctly, I think Wayne said the guy put his feet on the accelerator to see if he could catch up with the monk. But the monk was much faster than the train. But that was in Burma. They don't have very fast trains over there. I don't know if it would actually beat a French train. But anyway, he saw this fellow and then again sort of found out exactly who it was. So I had these really neat stories about monks flying around. So, cross-legged, he travels in space like a bird. With his hand, he touches and strokes the moon or sun, so powerful and mighty. He wields bodily mastery, even as far as the Brahma world. That's just basic psychic powers. And he got some more psychic powers with the divine ear element. That's just a name, that the heavenly ear element, which is purified and surpasses the human. He hears both kinds of sound, the divine and the human, those that are far as well as near. And when I was a young monk, first year, I think, in Ajahn Chah's monastery, there was one of the monks there who developed that ability. You know, he could actually, was sitting in the monastery, he could actually hear what was going on in the town, which was about, well, maybe about 10 kilometers away. But it's interesting what happened with him, because he had very, very good meditation, he started developing that psychic power, being able to hear sounds a long distance away. It was confirmed he was actually doing it. He got so egocentric that, you know, he thought he was fully enlightened. And one day he decided, you know, he was going to take over the monastery from Ajahn Chah and started sitting on his chair. You know, the ego got to him because, you know, he had this great power. But Ajahn Chah was very good, and soon he came to his senses. And then one morning he actually bowed to every monk in the monastery to ask forgiveness. You know, he realized he was very humble. He realized his mistake. But, you know, that's the time he actually did that, could actually have that divine ear. So these things, they do happen. But you've got to be careful, because the psychic powers can sometimes, unless you really developed a lot of wisdom, can lead to overestimation of your abilities. Sorry? Living comforting, what do you mean? Sure, because first of all, you'll be able to hear sounds without any control of it, but you'll soon be able to sort of find the cause and effects of those things and control it, so you can hear whenever you want, but you don't have to when you don't want to. So it's just the power of the mind, that's all. And the next one is mind reading. He understands the minds of other beings, of other persons, having encompassed them with his own mind. He understands a mind affected by lust as one affected by lust, one unaffected as unaffected. This is just standard here. Understand a mind affected by hate and one unaffected, a mind affected by illusion and one unaffected, a contracted, distracted, exalted, unexalted, surpassed, unsurpassed, mind as unsurpassed. He understands a concentrated mind as concentrated, an unconcentrated mind as unconcentrated. He understands a liberated mind as liberated, an unliberated mind as unliberated. In other words, that you've got someone who can actually read other people's minds. And there's been examples of that as well, which I've seen and known actually happens. You know, Ajahn Chah, if those of you want to read in that Opening the Door of the Heart, where he read the mind of Gary, the novice from New Mexico, who was thinking of his girlfriend. You know that story, when he told him to ask his girlfriend to send a bottle of her feces to him. That was an example of Ajahn Chah reading somebody's mind. But most monks or nuns, if they do actually develop that power, they don't really practice it, because most people understand that that is such an invasion of privacy. It is just something unethical about reading somebody's mind. I compare it to like reading somebody's personal mail. So you let people actually tell you, rather than going playing around with that. And then the eighth one, you recollect your manifold past lives with all the aspects and particulars. You recollect your manifold past lives. And those of you who've been on the retreats know, actually I try and teach people how to do this, to remember past lives. And the number nine, with a divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human, you see beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and you understand how beings pass on according to their actions. So here actually you can see people when they pass away, the stream of consciousness leaving one place, going to another place. And again, understanding just how that happens according to karma. And then, last of all, by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge, you, instead of here and now, it should be in this very life, enter upon the abiding, the deliverance of mind, the deliverance by wisdom, that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. That's, in other words, one is an arahat. So those are 10 qualities, they say, which are worthy of respect. First of all, you're virtuous, you are knowledgeable, you have contentment, you know how to meditate, and then 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, there's psychic powers, and number 10, you're fully enlightened. These Brahmin are the 10 qualities inspiring confidence that have been declared by the Blessed One who knows and sees the accomplishment of fully enlightened. When these qualities are found in anyone among us, we honor, respect, revere, and venerate them, and live in dependence on them, honoring, respecting them. In other words, it's the qualities of their conduct, their learning, their wisdom, their attainments, which is obviously worthy of confidence and worthy of respect. So it's the qualities which one is really respecting there, rather than the person. Again, understanding that we do have examples we like to live up to, inspiring people who motivate us to try and walk that same path. But it's the qualities rather than the person we venerate. And so we don't even make those sorts of people, even they've got psychic powers and can do all those amazing things, we don't make them the boss. The Dhamma is always the boss, is the leader. But these are the ones we venerate and use as our examples. Is that clear? Okay, we'll carry on. When this was said, the Brahmin Vasukava, the minister of Magadha, said to General Upananda, who's only just been mentioned, and so obviously this minister of works, when he was going around, he was going with a general to make sure that the fortifications and the building works were going to be able to sustain an invasion if necessary. So he said to his general, "What do you think, General, when these worthy ones honor one who should be honored, respect one who should be respected, revere one who should be revered, and venerate one who should be venerated, surely they honor one who should be honored, and venerate one who should be venerated. For if these worthy ones did not honor, respect, revere, and venerate such a person, then whom could they honor, respect, revere, and venerate? And on whom could they live in dependence, honoring, and respecting?" Then the Brahmin Vasukava, the minister of Magadha, said to the Venerable Ananda, "Where is the Master Ananda living now?" "Now I'm living in a bamboo grove, Brahmin." And any of you who've been to India know that bamboo grove is there situated. The town of Magadha will be in the center of that mountainous ring. And bamboo grove is very close to the little pass to the, I think it was to the west, was it, or to the north, to the northwest. So it's very close to the opening of the way out of that mountainous region. And so obviously it'll be well known to everybody. "Now I'm living in the bamboo grove, Brahmin." And the minister said, "I hope, Master Ananda, the bamboo grove is a pleasant, quiet, and undisturbed by voices, with an atmosphere of seclusion, remote from people, favorable for retreat." And that's actually a classic phrase which you see elsewhere in the suttas, of a monastery. That's what a monastery should be. It is, again, pleasant. So you don't want it too hot, or too many mosquitoes or something. No, it's supposed to be a pleasant place. Quiet and undisturbed by voices or by helicopters. With an atmosphere of seclusion, remote from people, favorable for retreat. So that actually almost gives you like a list of the suitable places to have monasteries. "Indeed, Brahmin, that bamboo grove is pleasant, favorable for a retreat, and it's because of such guardian protectors as yourself." And that was a very good piece of diplomacy for Ananda. I know as an abbot, you should always be very diplomatic to people in high places, like ministers, and you always thank them and say, "Oh, the reason why Serpentine Monastery and Dhammasara Monastery is such a good is because of, you know, the wonderful ministers of our government." And then they might protect you even more. And the minister was very happy with that. "Indeed, Master Ananda, that the bamboo grove is pleasant, favorable for retreat is because of the worthy ones who are meditators and cultivate jhanas, meditation. Now, that's actually where he says, no, it's not because of me. It's because you're meditating that's a quiet place. Again, a very lovely reflection there. Because even if you do have a secluded place, the atmosphere there is created by what you do in that place. And if you're meditating there, you create the atmosphere of quiet seclusion. Yes. Oh, yeah, some of them did meditate. That's very true, good observation. And this is actually the next part of it over here, actually is about the meditation. And we get one of the very, very powerful statements here, which you often hear me quote, which is one of the other reasons I want to read out this sutta here. We come into one of the very powerful statements of the Buddha. The worthy ones are meditate and cultivate meditation. On one occasion, Master Ananda, this is the minister saying, Master Gotama was living at Vaisali in the hall with a peaked roof in the great wood. And that's about, I think, 20, 30 k's north of Patna, on the other side of the Ganges, a long way from Rajagaha. Then I went there and approached Master Gotama, and in many ways he gave a talk about meditation. Master Gotama was a meditator and cultivated meditation, and he praised every type of meditation. This is what the minister said. And sure, they were meditators, but they never knew deeply what meditation was. And here we get the amazing saying of Venerable Ananda. The Blessed One Brahmin did not praise every type of meditation, nor did he condemn every type of meditation. What kind of meditation did the Blessed One not praise? Here, Brahmin, someone abides with his mind obsessed by sensual lust, a prey to sensual lust, and he does not understand, as it actually is, the escape from arisen sensual lust. While he harbors sensual lust within, he meditates, premeditates, outmeditates, and mismeditates. Now, obviously, sensual lust here, that's the first hindrance. And Bhikkhu Bodhi has done an excellent job here with that translation. Because in the Pali, they have like different words. Like the word for meditate is jhana, or jayati is the verb. And they have all these different prefixes there. And all have a slightly different meaning. So it's a play on words there, which is very, very difficult to capture. And actually in this case, Bhikkhu Bodhi has captured it 100%. In other words, he's not really meditating. He's a thinking, premeditating, outmeditating, but not doing the real thing. Or he abides with his mind obsessed by ill will, a prey to ill will. Or with his mind obsessed by sloth and torpor, a prey to sloth and torpor. With his mind obsessed by restlessness and remorse, a prey to restlessness and remorse. Or with his mind obsessed by doubt, a prey to doubt. And each one of these he does not understand as it actually is the escape from the arisen doubt. Remember, in each one of these hindrances, there is a way out, there an escape, and this is what one learns by being a meditator. While he harbors any of these within, he meditates, premeditates, outmeditates, and mismeditates. The Blessed One did not praise that kind of meditation. So any meditation, when there is any of the hindrances there, the Buddha says he does not praise. And this is the killer statement. On what kind of meditation did the Blessed One praise? Here, Brahmin, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states. The real translation here is secluded from the five hindrances, secluded from the world of the five senses and secluded from the five hindrances. A monk enters upon and abides in the first jhana. With a stilling of that movement of the mind towards and on that object, here called initial and sustained thought, which is not thinking at all, you enter upon and abide in the second jhana. With the fading away as well of rapture, you enter upon the third jhana. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, you enter upon and abide in the fourth jhana. The Blessed One praised that kind of meditation. In other words, the Buddha praised the jhanas, and only the jhanas. Yes. Well, you can actually see for yourself, answer that. The only meditation which the Buddha praised was the four jhanas. So we never actually put down any other teacher or teachings, as I said before. We just actually present another teaching. Okay, because as I understand the teachings of the Buddha, there is no distinction between insight and calm, because the two go hand in hand on the path to deep meditation, to the jhanas. The first 372 of the Dhammapada goes, Nati jhanang apanya sapanya nati ajayato yam hi jhanang japanya cha sawe nibbana santike. Which, if you listen to me long enough, you probably know what that means now. It means there's no jhana without wisdom, there's no wisdom without jhana. In the one with wisdom and jhana, they're in the presence of nibbana. And the wisdom element is what's created by vipassana, the jhana is created by samatha, and the Buddha is actually saying the two go together. Samatha leads to jhana, vipassana leads to wisdom. There's no wisdom without jhana, there's no jhana without wisdom. When you've got both of them together, you're in the presence of nibbana. They come together, they dance around each other. As you get insight, it leads to calm. As you get calm, you find insight. There is no insight without calm. And it's not really insight unless it leads to calm. So calm comes before insight, and insight becomes before calm. So the two work together. Yes. Well, the jhanas are very deep. It's the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path. If you want to have more information on those jhanas and their place, their essential place on the path, just copy my book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. It's actually a book on the jhanas, starting off with mindfulness and then jhanas and then the insight which comes afterwards, the enlightenment insights. But then they're not to be underestimated. Because you see here, the Buddha's saying specifically it's the only type of meditation which he praises. So there's something to those jhanas which is really important. Yes, yeah. The labels, yeah. Actually, the labels actually describe a place, just like a guidebook can explain sort of London or Paris, and so that you take those guidebooks, and when you go to those places, you can find out if those guidebooks are accurate or not. And there is sort of a commonality of those, because it doesn't depend upon the person, whether you are an Asian or a Caucasian, whether you're a male or a female, or whether you're a Buddhist or a Christian or a Muslim or whatever. It's actually the experience themselves. And this is actually the deep experiences of the jhana are very, very profound. Other people do get them as well, but they're still very, very rare. And remember that they need some calm, they need some insight. And when they've got the insight as well, when you get a good explanation of what they are, when you have the jhana and the wisdom, then you're in the presence of nibbana. If you've got jhana but no wisdom, then you're not. For more understanding of that, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond in the library. Well, if you can't afford that, on the shelves there for fee distribution is two of the journals, one on deep insight, the other one on enlightenment. So you can get one of those for free, just on the shelves in the reception area. Yeah, that's right, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, the book about meditation. Okay. So the Blessed One prays that kind of meditation, the four jhanas. It seems, Master Ananda, that Master Gotama censured that kind of meditation that should be censured and praised that kind of meditation that should be praised. Which, as you said, obviously that fellow had some idea of what meditation was, that he could actually appreciate Ananda's answer. And now, Master Ananda, we depart, we are busy, and we have much to do. Now is the time, Brahmin, to do as you think fit. It's also a reflection which I have on that passage, As a teacher, that sometimes that people want to talk to you about their worldly problems, and sometimes I get tired. And one of the best ways of dismissing people, I found in practice, is start to talk about meditation. And very often, as soon as you start talking about meditation, people say, well, I've got time to go now. Not everybody. Some people are actually interested in meditation. But a lot of people, they just want to have their worldly problems solved. So I don't know if that was the same thing which I experienced from time to time. Then the Brahmin Vasukara, the minister of Magadha, having delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Ananda's words, rose from his seat and departed. Then soon after he had left, the Brahmin Gopika Moggallana said to Venerable Ananda, Master Ananda has not yet answered what we asked him. Going back to the question from the beginning about did the Buddha set up a leader? And Ananda had to explain again, did we not tell you, Brahmin, there is no single monk, Brahmin, who possesses in each and every way all the qualities that were possessed by the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened? For the Blessed One was the arouser of the unarisen path, the producer of the unproduced path, the declarer of the undeclared path. He was a knower of the path, a finder of the path, the one skilled in the path. But his disciples now abide following that path and become possessed of it afterwards. Again, making the point, the only difference here, according to Ananda, between a Buddha and another enlightened being is the Buddha was first and the others came later. So even there, the hierarchy, as if the Buddha was something special, something even supernatural, and other beings who become enlightened are sometimes of a different order. Ananda's quote there is saying, no, that's not true. The only thing which Ananda is focusing on, which separates the Buddha from all the other enlightened beings, is just he was the first to do it in this cycle. Again, it creates a great equality, the egalitarianism, and the lack of making a Buddha stand way, way, way above other human beings, especially the enlightened beings. Sometimes it is the case in religions that sometimes the person who founded these leaders, these religions, get elevated beyond all proportion. Jesus becomes a son of God, almost equivalent to a god. An object which is far, far above an ordinary human being. And as you know from the original teachings of the Buddha stressed his humanity. And because the Buddha could become enlightened, stressing that he was an ordinary human being, he made it clear that any human being who follows the instructions can also have that same attainment. So it was a very much a democratic bringing the very heights of religion, religious attainments, to a level which ordinary people can attain. So it's a fascinating sutta, and hopefully I've brought out some aspects of it which you may have missed when you first read them. The Buddha wasn't a god. He wasn't something which was different than every other enlightened person. He was just the first. That's what it clearly says here. Any other questions or comments before we finish off today? Srila Pandika, yes? Oh yes, the Buddha had great teaching abilities. So you're telling a story where these two brothers, one of them became a monk and was very, very clever. The other brother was very, very dull-witted. And obviously that his elder brother, Mahapandika, tried to teach his younger brother but wasn't getting anywhere. I think his younger brother was about to disrobe, I think. But then the Buddha came up and taught him. I think if that was the case, he gave him like a cloth. As he was wiping the cloth, he noticed it got dirtier and dirtier. And he used that as the means of overcoming his sensory desire. Because whatever looks beautiful, delightful, after use it gets more soiled. So you can't have that perfection which sensory desire always requires and needs. And I think that was enough for him to become eventually fully enlightened. And the point which Nihal mentioned that was the Buddha's ability, actually as a teacher. You know, his resourcefulness, his means of teaching were so more profound than other people. So he was the great teacher. Anixel could teach people which other people couldn't teach. But that's not what Ananda was focusing on, his abilities as a teacher. His attainment was what he was focusing on. Okay, so is there any other questions before we finish off today? Okay, so that's the 108th Sutta, Gopika Moggallana Sutta. 108 is supposed to be a magic number in Buddhism. It's the same as the number of stories in my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. Apparently that somebody worked out that in the qualities of the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, itipiso bhagava, if you actually count the, not the vowels, count the, what do you call it? Syllables, yeah, the syllables. It, tit, pit, so, ba, ga, wa. Count the syllables, there's 108 in them, apparently. So there you go. So the next time I'm here, I'll try and do number 38. I'm not quite sure when that will be, because the next Thursday I'm going off to Singapore and Malaysia for a couple of weeks. But anyway, so glad you heard this sutta. Now we can give the... what do you usually do now? Do the Arahang Sama Sambuddha together.
Arahang Sama Sambuddha Bhagava Uddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhamman Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami